I think we have an obligation that we should not let redistricting change America.
Working on it. Wish us luck.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Morning.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up, what I will regard as a year-end roundup, if you will, of this year's continuing gerrymander wars that are going to continue into 2026, I'm afraid. They were kicked off initially, as you'll recall, in Texas by a desperate Donald Trump, desperate to hold on to a U.S. House majority that he fears, with very good reason, that he will otherwise lose next year for his party. We'll get you all caught up on where those wars began, where they now stand. Following the efforts by Republicans in Texas, Missouri, North Carolina, and Indiana specifically, and the Democratic responses so far in California and Virginia. But over the Thanksgiving holiday, after a three-judge lower court federal panel led by a Trump-appointed judge found the new Texas map to be an illegal racial gerrymander, after it wrote some five largely minority districts held by Democrats out of existence, well, the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court jumped right in, came to the defense of Trump and the Republicans to not just allow Texas to use its racial gerrymander in 2026, but also to offer a roadmap as to how any state may now gerrymander their maps before an election in a way that the courts cannot block them, even in cases where the map is blatantly unlawful, as is the case, Desiree Doyen, in your home state of Texas.
Yes, sadly, unfortunately. Sorry about that, guys.
We will talk about that with Jay Willis of the excellent legal website Balls and Strikes momentarily. But it is not just American elections and democracy that the Trump administration and his Republican supporters are seemingly desperately working to undermine at any cost. It kind of seems like it's the whole planet that they don't seem to mind crashing at this point. In 1960, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, or NCAR, as it's known, was established by the National Science Foundation, which was itself created by Congress. The National Center for Atmospheric Research is the flagship center for American climate science, for research in atmospheric chemistry and physical meteorology. All stuff that sounds kind of important. The center is responsible for many of the biggest scientific advances in humanity's understanding of both weather and climate. Its research aircraft and sophisticated computer models of the Earth's atmosphere and oceans are widely used in forecasting weather events and disasters around the country and the world, and its scientists study a broad range of topics, including air pollution, ocean currents, global warming. Again, stuff that's not just important here in the U.S., but to everyone. But the NCAR is much more than that. The center's research has often proved useful in unexpected places, notes the New York Times today, such as when its studies of downdrafts in the lower atmosphere in the 1970s and 1980s led to developments of wind shear detection systems around airports that helped address the cause of hundreds of aviation accidents during that era. I don't know about you, but I'm not a fan of flying, and I am delighted that we now have science that can talk to us about wind shears and how to avoid them Avoiding hundreds of aviation accidents.
Yeah, saving you from plane crashes. You can thank NCAR for that.
Yeah, seems like kind of a good thing. The year that the National Center for Atmospheric Research was founded by the National Science Foundation, way back in 1960, as climate journalist Brad Johnson points out today, way back in 1960, Life magazine explained the importance of NCAR's mission, noting at the time, quote, "While all this local research goes on, scientists emphasize that man unwittingly is carrying out the largest-scale weather control experiment of all time by upsetting nature's balance of carbon dioxide. If there is an excess of this gas in the atmosphere, it forms an insulating blanket, warming the air by preventing the Earth's heat from radiating into space. Man is constantly burning coal and oil, which give off carbon dioxide," Life magazine noted in 1960. "He is also turning forests, which absorb much carbon dioxide, into farmland, which absorbs little. Thus, he is adding a percent every year to the atmosphere's carbon dioxide. The oceans, which absorb carbon dioxide as insatiably as they do heat, will take up a third of this excess. But unless man switches to atomic fuels," as they described them at the time, "the amount remaining might be by the 25th century would raise the globe's temperatures 12 degrees Fahrenheit, enough to make the whole U.S. a semi-tropical land." You know, those you hear those climate deniers telling you that, well, back in the 70s, all the scientists thought that we were heading for a new ice age. Yeah, well, no, they weren't. As that clip from Life magazine back in 1960 proved, discussing pretty much what we discuss, almost every day on this program, certainly all the time on Desi Doyen's Green News Report.
Yep.
But today, however, the Trump regime is moving to kill NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, quote, "immediately. For the crime of, quote, climate alarmism." USA Today's Joey Garrison broke the story on Tuesday night, said the Trump administration is now moving to dismantle the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. That, according to a senior White House official, taking aim at one of the world's leading climate research labs. Trump officials have circled the federally funded research institution based in Boulder, Colorado, as a hub for, quote, "federal climate alarmism." After it was established decades earlier in 1960, the administration plans to identify and eliminate what it calls, quote, "green new scam research activities." Well, I wonder where they came up with that phrase. "Green new scam research activities" during an upcoming review of the center. They will eliminate that, according to the White House, while, quote, "vital functions," whatever they determine those to be, such as weather modeling and supercomputing, will be moved to another entity or location. The White House billed the restructuring as a return to the National Center for Atmospheric Research's original focus. But of course, all you got to do is read Life magazine from 1960, from the year that NCAR was founded, to understand its original focus. No, it hasn't become woke over there at NCAR. Said Russ Vogt, the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, who, by the way, Trump's own White House Chief of Staff, Susie Wiles, described in a Vanity Fair article just yesterday as a, quote, "right-wing absolute zealot," unquote. That guy, Russ Vogt, said in a statement to USA Today, quote, "The National Science Foundation will be breaking up the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. This facility is one of the largest sources of climate alarmism in the country. A comprehensive review is underway, and any vital activities such as weather research will be moved to another entity or location." So I guess it's okay to research weather, just not the climate that causes the weather?
Yeah, I think that is the completely corrupt and wholly insane definition that they are going with here.
Efforts to dissolve the NCAR will begin immediately, officials say, with the plan being to fully close the center's Mesa laboratory in Boulder. A laboratory, by the way, which Brad Johnson points out, the climate journalist
at hillheat.com.
Yeah. He points out that
he's very trenchant, very funny.
That laboratory was itself, the NCAR laboratory in Boulder, was almost destroyed by climate change fueled alarmism. Back in 2022, the fossil fueled so-called NCAR fire loomed over and forced the evacuation of 19,000 people not far from the location of the catastrophic fossil-fueled wildfire that destroyed 1,000 homes back in 2021. Fortunately, at the time, NCAR survived. It survived that, but it may not survive Donald Trump. The atmosphere's administration's move comes after Trump has also pushed massive cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, including eliminating the agency's Office of Oceanic and Atmospheric Research there and ending funding for its climate, weather, and ocean laboratories and cooperative institutes. As if you can cut off the funding, you can kill the institutions that do this work, and somehow climate change is not going to get worse and worse by the day, by the month, by the year, by the decade. Really? Obviously not. And by the way, you know who knows that? Obviously not. Even the fossil fuel industry, they know it damn well because they got more climate scientists over there than everywhere else. They know what's going on. They just want to make sure you don't know about what's going on. And Donald Trump is happy to do their bidding. NCAR's staff is made up of about 830 employees who are part of the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, or UCAR. That's a nonprofit consortium of more than 130 colleges and universities working together, focused on research and training in earth system sciences. So UCAR essentially runs NCAR, even though NCAR is funded mostly via congressional appropriations from the National Science Foundation, an independent federal agency that contracts the university consortium to manage the center. The NSF provided $123 million to NCAR in the 2025 fiscal year, accounting for about half of the center's budget. In addition to the Mesa Laboratory, the National Center for Atmospheric Research operates two critical and highly technological aircraft for atmospheric research, and they manage a federally owned supercomputing center in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
One of the things about that supercomputer, there are only a few computers in the world that are capable of handling a global climate model.
Mm. The massive amount of data that comes in to feed this thing.
It's a huge amount of data. It takes days to run these models, even weeks in some cases, depending on how complicated they are. NCAR has one of those few computers here in the U.S.
NCAR was originally founded to provide scientists studying Earth's atmosphere with cutting-edge resources like that, like supercomputers that individual universities cannot afford on their own. It is now widely considered a global leader in both weather and climate change research, with programs aimed at tracking severe weather events, modeling floods, and understanding how solar activity affects the Earth's atmosphere. All of that woke climate alarmism that we just don't worry your pretty little head about. For decades, they've operated with the freedom to develop outside-the-box ideas to advance weather forecasting. Its researchers identified atmospheric patterns that meteorologists now rely on to predict the weather today. In the 1970s, NCAR scientists Roland Madden and Paul Julian discovered a pulse of clouds and rain that circumvents the equator every 30 to 90 days. It's a phenomenon now known as the Madden-Julian Oscillation. It fundamentally changed the field to help forecasters predict weather patterns weeks to months in advance. You know how you get those alerts on your phone. You can look up what the weather is going to be 10 days from now. Didn't used to be able to do that.
Especially important when it comes to things like fire weather, when they are able to forecast in advance of that.
NCAR also developed GPS probes that are dropped from aircrafts into hurricanes, essentially, to gather data about a cyclone's strength. And the center, that data has become pivotal for the computer models that are used to predict hurricane paths. But the White House pointed to UCAR's, quote, woke direction, singling out several initiatives Trump officials said are wasteful and frivolous. Apparently, that is one of them. Trump, of course, regularly refers to climate change as a hoax or a con job, even though the vast majority of actual scientists say climate change is very real, and they are trying to raise the alarm over the rising temperatures. In 2024, we just all lived through the hottest year on record globally, and the heat in the uppermost layer of the ocean was also a record high, according to both NOAA and NASA. So all of this sort of coming out of nowhere here. We know he's going after NOAA, but going after this research center in Colorado. It all seems to be part of Trump's current anger of the day, I guess, at Colorado's Democratic Governor Jared Polis. Because Trump is attempting to bully Governor Polis into freeing Tina Peters. Her name may sound familiar. She's the former Mesa County, Colorado County clerk who broke into her own voting system room in the middle of the night after making a fake ID for one of her MAGA friends, a 2020 election denier, turned off the security cameras in the room and went about making unlawful copies of the voting system hard drives in a failed effort to prove that the 2020 election was stolen. She was eventually found guilty following a full trial. She's now serving 9 years in prison, and Donald Trump wants her free. He even issued a presidential pardon, even though she's in jail for a state crime. Presidents can't pardon those. So seemingly in revenge for that, Donald Trump is now going after the National Center for Atmospheric Research because it's in Colorado and it employs a whole bunch of people there. That's how sick and twisted this deranged man is who now lives in the White House. The move to break up the National Center for Atmospheric Research comes after the Trump administration earlier in the day announced the cancellation of $109 million in environmentally focused transportation grants in Colorado, seeking to boost electric vehicles, rail improvements, and research into hydrogen and natural gas-powered trains, which you would think Donald Trump and the fossil fuel industry would be in favor of. But many of the big advances in weather prediction originated at this research center, explained Daniel Swain last night in sort of an emergency podcast he put out. He's a climate scientist out here with the University of California. He's been a guest on the show. He's a research partner with NCAR since 2018. Unsurprisingly, climate scientists are, quote, in complete shock about this, quote, insane move, notes Brad Johnson. Dr. Kate Marvel said, we need to fight this with everything we have got. Dr. Peter Glick says, without hyperbole, quote, this is an intellectual war crime.
Yes, and Dr. Michael Mann, who we had on the show just recently, University of Pennsylvania, said, quote, not since the ransacking of the Library of Alexandria have we witnessed such a wanton, intentional assault on scientific knowledge. Dr. Jeff Masters at Yale, he's a former hurricane hunter. He said, this is like on the eve of World War II. We decided to drop funding R&D into weapons systems to develop advanced aircraft, ships, and tanks. Climate change is going to kick our butts if we lose NCAR and NOAA at a time when climate change is increasing extreme weather events capable of crashing the economy.
Here's how insane this is. Roger Pielke Roger Pilkey Jr., I don't know if you know the name or not. We know his name. He's a senior fellow at the right-wing American Enterprise Institute. He's frankly a climate change denier of sorts, or he probably calls himself a skeptic. He spent a third of his career at NCAR. He continues to study climate science and extreme weather events from Boulder, Colorado. He's vocal in his concerns over so-called climate alarmism and the politicization of climate science and weather disasters, as he describes it. But even Roger Pilkey described NCAR as a, quote, crown jewel of the U.S. scientific enterprise, and it deserves to be improved, not shuttered, he said. If the U.S. is going to be a global leader in atmospheric sciences, then it cannot afford to make petty and vindictive decisions based on the hot politics of climate change, said Pilkey. And when you've lost Roger Pilkey... Now, whether Trump has the legal authority to do any of this, to shut down NCAR, well, that remains to be seen. As noted, it is funded by the National Science Foundation, which is created and funded by Congress, not by the White House, as an independent executive agency. But, of course, Trump has been challenging the idea of independent executive agencies all across the federal government. He's now at the Supreme Court, even as we speak, attempting to argue that all such independent executive agencies as created by Congress are actually under the control of the president. Congress has nothing to do with it, even though Congress set them up, even though Congress funded them, even
though explicitly said they should be independent.
Well, not in the Trump administration, not as far as this deranged president is concerned. So he no doubt thinks that he can order the National Science Foundation to essentially shut down the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And he might be right. We will see. Currently, there is no director, no permanent director at NCAR. The last director was actually appointed by Donald Trump back in 2020. To serve a six-year term. Joe Biden didn't fire him. He allowed him to serve. But that guy has recently resigned himself. So now it's being run by, you know, a temporary interim leadership. So all of this remains to be seen, whether it will be legal or not. I suspect there will be a fight over this. At least I hope there will be. And it'll probably come back to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court has so far shown themselves to, you know, be all in Trump's court when it comes to independent executive agencies and doing whatever it is that Donald Trump wants them to do. So we'll see. But speaking of the court doing favors for Trump and the Republicans, let's take a quick break right here. And we'll be back on the Gerrymandering Wars beat at year's end with Jay Willis of Balls and Strikes on the huge and frankly ridiculous ruling regarding gerrymandering in Texas, and thanks to this absurd ruling, gerrymandering now in every other state in the union. We'll discuss all of that straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You can mess with the Republicans and the Democrats. You can mess with the liberals and the slick bureaucrats. You can mess with the media and a third world refugee. You can mess with Texas, but don't you mess with me.
Yeah, well, good news. They're messing with Texas and with you. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It has been, to say the least, a tumultuous year in the courts and in the states when it comes to what used to be the wildly rare case of a state legislature choosing to redistrict their U.S. House map in the middle of a decade. Normally, new maps are redrawn by the legislature just once a decade, just after the decennial U.S. Census, in order to comply with new population figures. But of course, everything is different now with a corrupt president who has been told by his corrupted U.S. Supreme Court that there is virtually no law that he is not allowed to violate, much less any norm or tradition that he can't blow up for virtually any reason that he chooses, including that it will benefit him either personally or politically, even if it might ultimately be found to violate the law and or the Constitution. With that in mind, as we have been covering for much of the latter part of the year, Donald Trump essentially ordered state lawmakers in the state of Texas initially to redraw their U.S. House map over the summer to essentially steal 5 seats currently held by Democrats in largely minority voting districts by gerrymandering the state's already gerrymandered map to help ensure that those 5 Democrats would be replaced by Republicans in the U.S. House next year, or at least that was their hope. So worried is Donald Trump, justifiably so, that his party will lose their currently razor-thin U.S. House majority next year that instead of changing his unpopular policies to ones that voters actually, you know, like, well, he is instead ordering Republican-controlled states to rewrite their U.S. House maps before next year's critical 2026 midterms in a way that seeks to guarantee a Republican majority before any voter has even had a chance to vote, to create districts where, in theory, a Democratic candidate simply cannot win. Well, Republican Governor Greg Abbott and the GOP-controlled Texas state legislature, they were all too happy to help out. They called a special session over the summer to do just that. They cracked 5 largely minority districts in order to ensure Republicans will win those seats next year. Again, that was their plan. In response, Democratic lawmakers in California, where House districts are determined by an independent redistricting commission, they called for a special election last month in November to allow state voters out here to decide if they wanted to respond in kind by temporarily rewriting the state constitution to allow for a U.S. House map that was designed to flip 5 Republican seats to the Democrats in California next year. Voters out here adopted that measure, Prop 50, by huge numbers in November, 64% to just 36% opposed. But the Republicans, they were not done, as Trump continued his directives to GOP-controlled states. Missouri lawmakers gerrymandered their U.S. House map to kill 1 of 2 remaining Democratic seats in the state. North Carolina lawmakers did the same. In response, Democratic state lawmakers in Virginia, which, like California, has a constitutional requirement that only an independent redistricting commission can redraw maps and only can do so every 10 years after the census, well, Virginia began a complicated procedure to change the state's constitution, which requires 2 votes by 2 separate state legislative sessions and a statewide ballot measure to approve all of it. That process is underway, and next year may result in a map that would flip 3 Republican-held U.S. House seats in the Commonwealth from red to blue next year. They got a lot of help, Democrats did, toward that end last month when Virginia voters elected Democrats by huge numbers right after they announced this plan. Last week, after months of pressure from the Trump administration, Republican lawmakers in Indiana, to their great credit, defying direct threats from Donald Trump and death threats from his supporters, said no, they would not rewrite their already very red U.S. House maps in Indiana in order to kill the state's last 2 Democratic districts. Also, a court in Utah a few weeks ago ordered a new, likely Democratic House district there in that otherwise very Republican state. Now, there may be more Republican states preparing to rewrite their House maps early next year, but overall, the pathetic, sleazy Trump scheme has, well, it had been largely a wash, and one where Democrats might have ultimately come out ahead, in fact. In fact, the gerrymander in Missouri is currently being challenged by a state voter initiative that should put the state's new map on hold next year in order to allow the matter to be decided by voters at the ballot box next November instead. And after a 9-day hearing down in Texas, where evidence and witnesses were presented, a federal U.S. District Court panel in Texas ruled just before Thanksgiving that the new map originally drawn by GOP state lawmakers over the summer in the Lone Star State was in fact an unlawful racial gerrymander, where new districts were illegally drawn based on the color of voters in those districts. That ruling came from a 3-judge federal panel after that 9-day hearing, and it was written by a Donald Trump-appointed federal judge. Now, while the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court back in 2019 determined that partisan gerrymanders were no longer unlawful, partisan gerrymanders, or at least that the federal courts could have no say in such gerrymanders, racial gerrymanders under Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act were and are, for the moment, still are prohibited, as the lower court in Texas noted when they struck down the new racially gerrymandered Texas map in November. It looked, in fact, like the Trump GOP scheme was going to be even more of a bust than previously thought, at least until the matter was appealed by Texas to Donald Trump's friends at the U.S. Supreme Court. After a few days supposedly looking at the matter over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, the court's 6-3 Republican majority announced in early December, just days before the December 9 deadline to file to run in next year's primary elections in Texas, which are held in March, the Supreme Court, on their so-called emergency shadow docket, put a hold on the lower court's fact-based finding that the Texas redistricting was, in fact, an illegal, unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The Supreme Court put a stop to it. As SCOTUS blog reported at the time, the Supreme Court gave the green light to Texas's efforts to be able to use a new congressional map favorable to Republicans in the 2026 elections, despite a lower court's ruling that the map unconstitutionally sorts voters based on race. In a very brief, unsigned opinion, a majority of the Supreme Court granted the state's request to pause the lower court ruling issued by the 3-judge district court in El Paso. The Supreme Court's 5-paragraph order indicated that, quote, Texas is likely to succeed on the merits of its claim that the district court committed at least 2 serious errors. Moreover, it added, the lower court, quote, improperly inserted itself into an active primary campaign, in November of this year before next November's 2026 elections and its primaries in March of next year, quote, causing much confusion and upsetting the delicate federal-state balance in elections. Really? As legal journalist Jay Willis over at Balls and Strikes noted, the opinion in Abbott versus League of United Latin American Citizens argues that the district court blocked the Texas gerrymander violated the so-called Purcell principle, which we will explain in a moment. But as Justice Elena Kagan pointed out in dissent for all 3 liberals on the court, as Willis notes, the unsigned majority opinion helpfully shows state lawmakers how they can hold future elections using blatantly illegal maps without ever having to worry about the threat of judicial review, as long as lawmakers time the rollout of their racist redistricting plans just right. Here to explain this seemingly corrupt high court judicial madness is Jay Willis, former attorney, now editor-in-chief of Balls and Strikes, a nonprofit legal website focused on the courts and named after Chief Justice John Roberts' now laughable claim during his Senate confirmation hearings way back in 2005. That the proper role for a Supreme Court justice was to do nothing more than, quote, call balls and strikes and not pitch or bat. Please hold your laughter. Jay Willis, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Brad, thank you for having me. I'm a little disappointed that you just ruined my invitation to Chief Justice John Roberts to be a guest columnist for the site. I'm not sure he's going to take me up on that now.
I know. He probably wouldn't have noticed that your site was called Balls and Strikes and had anything to do with him. So my apologies for that. And of course, to the chief. So there was a lot of detail in that introduction, Jay, and I didn't even get to the part of all of this, the Louisiana case being heard by the Supremes in October, that was heard in October, that could even further corrupt this entire mess next year. But we'll get to that in a bit, along with Justice Kagan's dissent. But first, we got to start here. What is the Purcell principle, and how could it possibly come into play in December of 2025 in advance of an election that will not be held until November of 2026?
Even talking about the Purcell principle, I sort of feel kind of silly because it comes from a 2006 Supreme Court case that was like not a landmark or a blockbuster case. In it, the justices were ruling on whether I believe it was a voter ID law in Arizona could be implemented. And as part of the opinion, they said that ordinarily, close to elections, judges shouldn't do things that interfere with like the rules of elections. Mm-hmm. And the rationale they cited for that is that they don't want courts causing, and I'm quoting here, voter confusion.
Okay.
Now, on its face, doesn't seem that unreasonable. Elections are complicated. People have to take time to vote. People have to take time off from work to find their polling place. Let's not do things that are going to make it more challenging for people to participate in democracy. Mm-hmm. But in the hands of primarily these Republican justices, the problem is that in the, 20 years since, the Purcell principle has gotten stretched to the point of meaninglessness now, where anytime the justices decide that we are too close to an election in a way where changing the rules would hurt Republicans, they just say, Purcell principle, can't do that. And that's what happened here, as you say, 11 months before the November 2026 midterms, or if you want to be really generous, right, 3 or 4 months before the Texas primaries, which, by the way, the Texas legislature could reschedule if it's so wanted.
Now, the original Purcell case, we were talking just days before an election. Election rule was changed, or a decision was made about that election rule, and it kind of made sense. We don't want people to be confused about what sort of IDs they need to show at the polling place and so forth just days before, not 11 months before the election.
Yeah, there's even one formulation of this of the Purcell principle from 2020, in which the court described the Purcell principle as forbidding changes on the eve.
On the eve,
right? It's Christmas season.
Yes.
The day before an election. And now that principle, which used to be, 24 hours or 72 hours or whatever, is almost an entire calendar year in the hands of this court.
Is Purcell principle, is it a law? Is it written into statute? Or just like the court's so-called presidential immunity doctrine, is it, that was somehow discovered in the Constitution? Who knew last year, allowing presidents to violate the law? Is this something that the Supreme Court itself gets to decide how it works, how it's applied, when it's applied? Is it something simply made up by this court at this point?
Yeah, it's not a law or a statute. It's a creation of the court. And again, lots of the legal doctrines that are getting abused to the point where they're unrecognizable share this feature, which is, on its face, seems reasonable enough. But the people who are applying the principle matter just as much as the principle.
Yeah.
And what we've seen time and again is that the court uses it at its convenience to implement rules that favor Republicans and cast it aside when it doesn't find it would be useful for its electoral interests.
Now, after Republican lawmakers in Texas at Donald Trump's urging, or at his orders, essentially, after they adopted this map this year in August of 2025, you note that the challengers to that map, knowing that this Supreme Court has used, or more aptly misused, the so-called Purcell principle in recent years, they seemingly understood that and went out of their way to avoid getting caught up in what you describe as the Purcell trap. How so? What did they do to avoid, or at least to try to avoid, the Purcell trap in August of 25?
Yeah, what's so frustrating reading this opinion is you can tell that everyone involved, the challengers to the map, the Texas Republicans who implemented it, and the justices who ultimately decided the case, everyone knew that they would have to deal with Purcell. And so the challengers to the map, they filed for an injunction before Texas Governor Greg Abbott had even signed the map into law. Basically, they were getting the ball rolling in federal court.
Right.
They also waived their right to discovery. Now, typically in a case like this, you would seek emails and documents and draft maps from the map makers. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to prove that a map is an illegal racial gerrymander, which is the claim in this case, you would want documents that maybe show that's the case. Mm-hmm. And here the challenger said, look, we're not going to bother with that because time is of the essence here. We know that under this Supreme Court's election law jurisprudence, I'm using that term very loosely, we know that under this court's jurisprudence, we are running up against Purcell, where the court is going to say that courts can't be interfering with new rules, which includes a gerrymandered map like this. As Kagan put it in her dissent, nobody dilly-dallied here. Everybody was trying to get this resolved as quickly as possible. But that wasn't good enough for the court. The court still said that this is too close to what it described 5 years ago as the eve of an election.
Mm-hmm.
And so the implication of this, as Kagan points out, is the court has showed lawmakers, has basically given lawmakers an instruction manual for how to conduct one free election.
Right.
Not subject to the law, not subject to the Constitution. Because all they have to do is make changes to the law, you know, within a couple months of the election, and courts will, you know, just sort of wash their hands and say, sorry, under Purcell, there's nothing we can do here.
The idea that the challengers in Texas declined discovery, where you would see, generally, you would see lawmakers, you know, writing back and forth to each other, emails talking about how they were going to make the changes to these maps, comments, those emails and so forth would then be included as part of the a trial or a hearing on this. They said, forget it. We don't have time for that. Let's just get right to the hearing. They still had, what was it, a 9-day hearing on this that apparently is less important than what the Supreme Court now decides. Well, it's just too late to do it. Never mind that 9 days of hearings and that Trump-appointed federal judge who wrote the ruling. I mean, do the finding of facts don't even come into play here because they declare Purcell principle, it's too late, none of that matters, it doesn't matter whose vote is getting suppressed, who is being racially gerrymandered. The important thing is we stay on some imaginary schedule.
Yeah, even the district court was aware of Purcell. The district court opinion, as you mentioned, the district court conducted lengthy hearings, right, took testimony, did its job, and it published a 160-page opinion just a month after the parties finished briefing the case. Like, relative to the usual pace of federal litigation,
yeah,
that is warp speed in terms of getting out an opinion. But again, it's all about what the court at the top decides. And when you have a 6-justice conservative supermajority, they are going to massage these sort of vague principles that they've outlined in order to best fit with their agenda.
Now, when it comes to the Purcell principle, We have seen, of course, secretaries of state, local election officials making decisions about election laws at the last minute. You know, which photo IDs, you know, will allow you to vote, which ones won't, how close you're allowed to be to the you know, to the polling place when you're electioneering and all of that. Does the Purcell principle apply to those decisions? If a secretary of state makes a ruling, you know, the week before early voting starts, is that too late because of the Purcell principle?
Yeah, the Purcell principle is all about the conduct of federal judges. It defers pretty heavily to lawmakers, you know, the people who are implementing these rules. And it says that judges shouldn't be interfering in elections. But that does not address lawmakers or executives' attempts to interfere with elections, right? To change the rules. So what this rule amounts to, again, is sort of a free pass for Republican officials to conduct elections outside the scope of the law, as long as they basically get the timing right.
So, I mean, what I'm trying to wrap my brain around here, Jay Willis, is that, you know, when election officials make these decisions about election rules and so forth, people then take those matters to court. And, you know, let's say a secretary of state says you can't use a student ID as a as an ID to vote, makes that as a, you know, an announcement just before voting starts. Someone goes to court, someone challenges that in court. The courts say, you're right, absolutely, it cannot be used. This rule cannot be created right now. Would the Supreme Court be able to come in and say, well, the court has no basis for saying that because of Purcell? It's just too late. We just have to go with whatever the Secretary of State says.
What I find frustrating about, you know, another thing that I find frustrating about this opinion. Sorry, I've got more than one item on that list.
Me too. Don't worry. Yeah.
A lot of times when you're discussing Supreme Court opinions, you're discussing long back and forth exchanges between the majority and the concurrence and the dissent, talking about different jurisprudential methods, comparing the relative strength and weight of different precedents, different facts, so on and so forth. And as Kagan points out in her dissent, this is one of those cases where you can set aside all the legalese and just take a step back. You don't have to have a law degree to understand that a racially gerrymandered map is illegal and unconstitutional unless the legislature that passes it waits until close to an election.
Yeah.
Like that just can't be how the law works. Yep. A law that allows racial gerrymanders to remain in place in an election, as will be the case for Texas in 2026, that's just not a law that functions. That is not a tenable status quo.
So Justice Kagan, in her dissent on behalf of the court's three liberals, she makes the central and kind of mind-blowing point that at this point, and you describe this as a thought that a child could spot regarding the damage that this shadow docket ruling will cause. She points out that this is a step-by-step roadmap for how states now may create any blatantly illegal, discriminatory maps that they want in a way that they cannot be ruled against prior to an election, as long as they pass it in a way that there's no time to, you know, to adjudicate it. But here, it would seem there was plenty of time. I mean, it was, you know, the map was created in August of 25. The election is not until November of 2026. It's a roadmap. Would you expect other states to take a hint from that and do the very same thing anytime between now and next year or any other election in the future?
Yeah, of course, Texas is not the only state to be doing this at Trump's behest and or in response to his threats to them. Indiana's plan, as you mentioned, recently went down in flames after Indiana Republicans even declined to support it. But this is happening in other states, too. There is an effort underway in Missouri to further gerrymander that state. And I think most interesting to your point, in Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has told the legislature, hey, let's wait a little bit before we do redistricting.
Right.
Because we, as you mentioned, there is this case in Louisiana in which the Supreme Court could gut what little remains of the Voting Rights Act. So DeSantis's position is, look, we could start redistricting now and maybe get tied up in court, or we can wait until the Supreme Court issues its decision in the Louisiana case and then have more leeway than ever to divide up the state as we see fit.
That, of course, is the Louisiana versus Calais case that was heard at the High Court in October. The state there is arguing that a majority-minority voting district ordered by the federal court in compliance with the Voting Rights Act is actually itself an unlawful racial gerrymander, apparently discriminating against white people in this case, as I understand it. After that oral argument, most of the voting rights experts that I follow and we talk to on this show think that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and its prohibition on racial gerrymandering is now also done for, along with the court's earlier ruling that partisan gerrymanders are now perfectly lawful on the federal level. Is it your assessment here that the court is going to gut Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, much of the Roberts Court's jurisprudence, especially when it comes to sort of the law of democracy, has proceeded incrementally. And there's a pretty clear analogy to how the court's conservatives went about overturning Roe v. Wade. You know, there was a 50-year attack on that precedent that ultimately culminated in Dobbs once they had the votes. And you can see the same thing happening here.
Right.
Conservatives have long been opposed to the Voting Rights Act. As a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department, Roberts was part of Roberts' portfolio was advocating for weakened renewals of the Voting Rights Act's language. This has been something that he has been, you know, concerned about, campaigning against, opposing, basically for his entire adult life. And we are now at the stage where the court already got rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act functionally in 2013. As you mentioned, they sort of greenlit partisan gerrymandering in Rucho in 2019. Mm-hmm. And this Louisiana case, I think, is sort of the last domino to fall. It pertains to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is the last way that challengers to election laws are supposed to be able to, you know, enforce, uphold, protect their rights. And once that goes down, the law will just sort of exist as a nice sounding aspirational nullity that doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, that's you conclude your piece on this at Balls and Strikes by arguing, quote, there are two explanations for the court's decision. Either the conservative justices wanted to empower lawmakers to discriminate against voters of color, or they are too dumb to understand that in their haste, they provided a step-by-step instruction manual for doing exactly that. A third option occurs to me, Jay. It's similar to your first option there, but that, you know, they don't mind lawmakers discriminating against voters of color, but the court here, basically, they plan to rule in this Louisiana versus Calais case after hearing the oral arguments in October. They're simply going to. They know what they're going to do. They know they're going to gut the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so they're basically just jumping ahead, as they did when they had that case on abortion from Texas. They basically put the challenge against that on hold in the same way, basically to allow them to have time to overturn Roe. This feels a whole lot like the very same thing that they did with Roe that now they're going to be doing with the Voting Rights Act. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think there's also an important, I think there's also an important point here about, you know, if you go back to the Purcell principle designed to prevent voter confusion, well, whose confusion do they care about? Whose interests do they care about? Who are they looking out for? In my view, what federal judges should be concerned with is the ability of normal people to participate in a meaningful way in democracy. And by deciding the case this way, the court has shown that its primary interest is in protecting the you know, the electoral fortunes mm-hmm. of Republican congressional primary candidates, I guess. I mean, the idea the idea that there are people who will not be able to have their voice heard, like, is of no interest to the court's justices. What they care most about is ensuring that these Republican, you know, aspiring members of Congress who got all psyched that they would have an even friendlier map to run on
yeah.
in 2026, ensuring that they can get their ducks in a row in time to get their names on the ballot.
Well, it's the notion that they, quote, improperly inserted itself, the lower court, into an active primary campaign that has not yet even begun, that, you know, the deadline for signing up to be a candidate had not yet even run out, that is causing, quote, much confusion and upsetting the delicate federal-state balance in elections, unquote, is just as absurd, unfortunately, as so many rulings we have seen from this particular Roberts Court in recent years. Jay Willis is a former attorney, now editor-in-chief of Balls and Strikes, a website that you should check out at ballsandstrikes.org. Their tagline is, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition since 2021. Little inside joke for court watchers there. Jay, always a delight speaking with you, sir. You can also follow them on the Blue Skies at ballsandstrikes.org. It's a delight to speak with you, sir. Thank you for joining us over the holiday season, and I look forward to speaking to you after the first of the year about all of the new messes that I suspect are coming our way.
Likewise. Thank you, as always, for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. All right, we have got to get out, but boy, our work is cut out for us, it looks like, in the new year when we have to overcome all of these nightmares at the ballot box, despite how difficult this court seems to want to make it for all of us. You know, Josh Marshall over at Talking Points Memo has been writing for months now that the yeah. only way any of this is going to be overcome is with Supreme Court reform, and that ought to be a litmus test for any Democrat running for office. Do you support reforming this corrupt Supreme Court or not?
Expanding it, restoring and reforming.
Yep. And I couldn't agree more. All right, got to get out. Thanks again to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to our guest today, Jay Willis, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. That is free thanks to those of you who hit a donate button when you're over there, or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Please, please keep us in mind for your end of year giving. We really count on you. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Digby and Driftglass?
Yes.
All right. Wonder if we'll have anything to talk about with them. We will look forward to that. Until then, I am Bradcast at bradblog.com. Find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.